Welcome everyone to this week's episode of the Electric Podcast. I'm Fred Lambert, your host, and I'm joined by Seth Weintraub. How are you, Seth?
I'm good, Fred. How are you?
Great, thank you. So Seth is joining us from a hotel room in Milwaukee right now, so if there's any connection issue, it's his fault.
Yeah, and it's not yours. And no. You're in a Hollywood Hills, I believe, right?
Yeah, I'm back in Los Angeles right now. Earlier this week, I was in Northern California for a while to test out the Audi e-tron on a road trip. We're going to have more to talk on that soon. And of course, last week when we last talked, I was in Norway to test out the Mercedes EQC. But at that time, I was under embargo, couldn't talk to you guys about my impression of the car, or at least a driving impression. But we're going to get into that later on in this episode, because now I can talk about it. And I just published now my thoughts on it. So if you check out Electric, yeah, you should be able to see that. But first off, let's start with Tesla, as we always do, because there was a bunch of not major Tesla news this week, but just interesting enough that we're more speculating about than the news itself, I think. Starting with battery technology. The Army, more specifically the CCDC Army Research Laboratory, they released a paper this week about new battery technology, more specifically a different chemistry that's completely free of transmission metal. So sort of like it's sort of in a liquid electrolyte. It's more in an energy-dense aqueous nature electrolyte. And they can combine that with another development that battery development that they had earlier this year, and the two together, it creates, like, that's going a bit over my head. Of course, I'm not a chemist, but the combination of the two creates a new battery chemistry that is very promising for increasing energy density, and also battery safety. It should very improve battery safety. So of course, like, as you know, like, if you burst, you penetrate the lithium battery, it would burst in flame almost immediately. Not the case here. And of course, why they did it, why the Army is working on that, is because many soldiers are carrying a lot of batteries, and making those batteries safer, so they're going to make their experience of carrying them safer. And if you can make them lighter too, it's going to have a big impact on the soldiers, because some soldiers apparently carry between 15 and 25 pounds of battery alone, just battery packs. So if you can make that 20-30% lighter, that's a big difference. So what was interesting about Tesla regarding this is that when they released the paper, they had a bunch of battery experts comment on it. And one of those battery experts was Jeff Dahn. We, of course, we know as Tesla's main battery research partner. He's Don is known as some people actually list him as an inventor of the lithium-ion battery. So, but he was involved early on in the development, and he's credited to make it so that to push the longevity of lithium-ion battery much further, be able to handle more cycle, which ultimately resulted in the commercialization of the lithium-ion battery, because you needed to be able to handle a lot of cycles. Speaking of cycles, what they have right now, what they demonstrated, is only 150 cycles. So it's not anywhere near commercialization right now. But Jeff Dunn, what he said about it, he was extremely impressed. And I'm looking for his comment right now. He said that the paper by the University of Maryland and the Army team is the most creative new battery chemistry I've seen in the last 10 years. So that's a guy that has seen pretty much any new battery chemistry related to lithium-ion in forever, and he's extremely impressed by it. But, of course, he mentioned that there's still limitation, and that there's a long way to go before our conversation, but he's excited about the research. So very interesting here, because we always see people claiming new battery breakthroughs, but as soon as other expert comments on it, it's always like, yeah, but it's never happening, or it's a good demo battery, but it never going to end up in conversation. Interesting that Jeff Dahn was working right now to put new chemistries in conversation, is excited about this battery technology here, which they claim can lead to an energy density of up to 460 watt-hour per kilogram. That's almost double what is believed to be in the Tesla's current battery cells, double the energy density. So what it would mean is that for the same weight, you could have twice the energy capacity. So a 100 kilowatt hour battery pack could be 200 kilowatt. Well, that's not true. That's at the cell level, not at the battery pack level. But you know what I mean. Like the battery pack doesn't make that big of a difference.
Or more realistically, the batteries could weigh close to half of what they currently weigh.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. That well, that's more realistic. You're right, because you don't really
you don't need it.
Yeah.
Right.
You don't need a 200 kilowatt hour battery pack, but a 100 kilowatt hour battery pack that, let's say, weighs 40% less than it does right now, that's incredible, because you're going to get a lot more range out of it. It's going to be more fun to drive, because, of course, electric cars are a bit heavy right now. So what I like to remind everyone, though, when we talk about battery breakthroughs like that, is that we don't need them for the adoption of electric vehicles. Like, that's a big breakthrough if it ends up in commercialization, if you can bring that to production at a decent price. But incremental improvement are always happening in the industry. The battery is always improving. And just with the current battery technology right now, it's extremely competitive with gas-powered cars. And with just a few years of incremental improvements, it's already taking over, basically. But seeing things like that would what would it mean basically is a rapid acceleration of the pace of adoption of electric vehicles to even more competitive batteries. Speaking of which, do you have something to add? Or?
Oh yeah, well I was just going to add that there's other things going on that happen in parallel to this technology that could also reduce the weight and make it less expensive, which I think is a good transition to what you were talking about.
Yeah, about the Maxwell acquisition. Yeah, we've been talking about that for a few months now, but it's finally happened. Yesterday, Tesla officially closed the acquisition after months of negotiation and work with the SEC to transfer the share, because it's a pure share transaction. It's worth over $200 million, but Tesla is not just giving $200 million to Maxwell shareholders. They are converting their own shares to Tesla shares and giving that to investors, which, of course, it's a little bit less appealing for some people right now, because the shares are at like over a 2-year low, I think.
Yeah, over a 2-year low, and today they dropped even more.
Yeah,
it's kind of a bloodbath at this point. Like it's 50% down from like highs, or even more so. What's interesting to kind of go back to technology on Maxwell is that Tesla's probably been pursuing Maxwell for quite some time.
Years, they said.
So we're not sure if Tesla's interest in Maxwell. I mean, we have a kind of a feeling that Tesla's interest in Maxwell is about the dry
electrode technology.
Yeah, but they also do some supercapacitor stuff that might be interesting as well. And in addition to that, so the supercapacitor stuff would be kind of cool, because I think supercapacitors are quite expensive right now, and they're not being produced in bulk, and I don't think they will be anytime soon. But a supercapacitor could also, you don't have to have a battery or a supercapacitor. You could have them both. So, like, theoretically, you could charge quite quickly with a supercapacitor, and you can discharge quite quickly. So you could have a ton of power and a ton of charging with just a small supercapacitor and the rest of batteries. But I want to go back to Elon Musk during a conference call, and I believe it was an earnings call about a year ago. He was asked about whether the Gigafactory producing lithium ion was, were there any big breakthroughs? And he's like, no, not really. There's no breakthroughs. And then he thought about it for a second. And then he said, well, there's one thing. Do you think that one thing was Maxwell? Do you think he was pointing to that?
The timing would make sense.
Yep.
The timing would make sense, because that's about when they started publicizing their technology. That's about when Tesla also started talking to them more seriously, I think.
Mm-hmm.
Leading up to December, when they were really like, all right, we're looking to buy you guys. But I think it's likely to make sense, because it's really something that also makes sense for Tesla, where they could incorporate that into the current battery cell production. Well, Panasonic's battery cell production, or more easily. It's not that big one overall of the entire system, because it's one component of the battery cell that changes, and that alone should make a big impact on cost, which is something Tesla is pushing, on longevity, which is also something Tesla is pushing, and we can also tie that to other recent comment about Elon Musk about making a 1,000,000-mile battery pack and things like that. So longevity is something that they're pushing a lot, especially in the context of the robo-taxi fleet. So you need some vehicle that lasts a long time. And also maybe a little bit of a boost of energy density, but I don't think that's Tesla's main concern at this point, energy density. I think longevity and costs are more important. Now they are officially taken over that technology from Maxwell. But like you said, they never confirmed that the dry electrode technology was what they were looking at, but it looks extremely likely. Going back to the ultracapacitors, though, you talk about them being used in electric vehicles, but if you look at Maxwell's own literature on it, it looks like if there's anything that would work with Tesla on the capacitor side, it's more about the energy storage, actually, stationary energy storage for the quick discharge and charging capacity.
Mm-hmm.
They are talking about adding those to a stationary energy storage station where you would be able to, due to the rapid discharge capability, to make an impact on frequency stabilization of the load on the electrical grid, which is something that Tesla has been doing with their big battery system, like the one in Australia and things like that. So I'm not sure if that's in the plan with Tesla, but it's something to consider when it comes to the fact that as of yesterday, Tesla is now an ultracapacitor business, really, because they are producing those. That's already a blessing. The dry electrode thing, there's no production of it yet. It's just it's just high P, basically, though they have demonstration cells that have been doing very well, apparently. So I'm sure that Tesla already have those in their lab, and that's why, I'm not sure, but I think the main reason is really the dry electrode technology, and they tested it, and they know that it works, and they want to implement it in their own battery production.
And hadn't Maxwell been working with another EV maker, I want to say Volvo or something?
I think Volvo, you're right. I think it was some hybrid thing. They were working on a hybrid from Volvo.
So that's not going anywhere anymore?
It might be. It might still be. I mean, it wouldn't be the first time that Tesla acquires a company that was working with other automakers. I mean, we can go back to Grumman. We can go back to a few others. So if they have a deal with them, they will honor it until the contract is over, and then focus only on Tesla project like they did with Grumman. But yeah, very exciting stuff, I think, on the battery front, because, like I said, we don't exactly need it. Incremental improvement are good, but if there's a breakthrough, it would accelerate everything a lot. And I think we need that. I mean, if you guys would be take a look at the electric room sometimes, where we always share those kind of depressing articles about the latest research that's showing that we're dying and stuff like that. That the herd is dying. It's we're always looking for some kind of hope on the technology side, because on the policy side, on the actual climate research, it looks grim as hell.
Yep. And so also Tesla this week increased the price of the Model 3. Was it 400?
400 on all variants of the vehicle. $400.
Kind of a weird...
It happens at the same time with people were all freaking out about the Chinese tariffs again, even though full vehicles weren't included in the tariffs, but parts could be. So like if Tesla is buying parts from China, vice versa, could increase the price. But we asked Tesla about it, and they didn't say it was related to the pricing. They just said, sometimes we change our prices, so deal with it, which has been Tesla's policy for a while now.
As pricing changes go, this was a pretty mild one.
Yeah, it is. But there's no $35,000 Model 3 anymore, because it's the $35,400 now. Because the $400
it still rounds down.
Yeah, doesn't apply to just the model listed on Tesla's website. It also applies to the ones that are off the menu, like the $35,000 base version, and also the long range rear wheel drive version, which I don't know that was because of all the talk about the 35,000 version. I think not a lot of people know that also the long range rear wheel drive version is also available off the menu. And that happened at the same time, but we just talked about it a little less because of course the focus is on the cheapest version. Mm-hmm. That went up by $1,400 because they also included the base package of the Autopilot as standard on the car now. So it didn't have it as an off the menu item like the $35,000 version didn't have it. The $35,000 version that becomes the $35,400 version still doesn't have Autopilot, but the long range rear wheel drive one has it now. Didn't affect the loan price. The standard range plus still start at just $400 a month. If you have that, what is it? I think it's $4,500 that you need to put down.
Yep.
But $400 per month for a Model 3, it's pretty good.
Okay. All right, so we got an email this week.
Did we?
One of us did. It sounds like Elon is cutting costs again, but hardcore this time.
Yeah, and that's his word, hardcore. Right. Yeah, we didn't get the email. Elon sent it to employees. Then we magically receive a copy. And he's going – hardcore is the word, really, because he's asking all employees to take ownership of expenses within their – if he wants every group, every team within Tesla to look at expenses that are related to them and take ownership of them and see ways to reduce them. Which is not that's our car in itself, but what's our car is that Elon himself and the CFO will review every expenses out there from that ownership after they take ownership of it. And they,
that's interesting. I wonder,
reduce it, they will. Sorry, you lagged for a second. I didn't get what you said.
Oh, no. I was going to say, it's interesting. I wonder if Elon himself is also going to start cutting his costs. I know he flies from L.A. to San Francisco quite a bit.
That's travel expenses, because travel expenses...
start taking the train, maybe.
Travel expenses is listed in the things that you need to look at. I mean, they said everything, including parts, salaries, travel expenses and rent. Everything is going to be included. And Zach Kirkhorn, the new CFO, will review every page of outgoing payment, and Elon will review and sign every 10 page. So he's not going to look at everything, but he's going to look at one every 10 page. So, and you don't know which page, so Elon might be looking at your expenses, so you're going to be more careful. That's, I think, the goal here. But yeah, I mean, it comes after, of course, Tesla lost $700 million last quarter, and Elon even mentioned with the cash position, with the new $2-something billion that they got from the capital raise last week, which was for general operations. So we thought that Tesla was in a better position, but he said that they just have a 10-month left if they continue at the Q1 burn rate. So they need to reduce the burn rate. But at the same time, we were thinking that burn rate was also mostly due to some issues with deliveries in Q1 due to the European expansion of the Model 3, things like that. So a lot of people thought it was on the revenue side of things, that things weren't going that well, and sure thing, because the revenue went way down in Q1. Margins were a little bit down too, so that's on the cost side. But it does come at a weird time.
Tesla right now is trading at 211. That's down 7.5% and 17 points. That's the lowest it's been probably, almost five since the very beginning of 2017.
Yeah,
that's pretty crazy.
Yeah, even though Tesla is selling more cars than ever right now, and
people love the cars, which is crazy. Like, it doesn't make sense to me how everything kind of fell into place and then everything kind of fell apart.
Yeah, I argue that the Model 3 program is the most impressive vehicle program in forever. I mean, the growth has been insane. It's universally loved, aside from a bunch of haters, but those that I think have other reasons to hate the car than the car itself. Yeah, and it's a revolutionary coolant being the first mass. Well, you could argue that there's other mass market vehicle, but I think the Model 3 is truly the first long range mass produced vehicle. I wouldn't say mass market necessarily because of the $35,000 issue, or you need to bring the price down a little bit. The base one at $40,000 now, it's not exactly that price we're hoping for, but it's getting close to there.
Yeah, now that I'm actually looking at it, it hasn't been below 213, or it hasn't been this low since late 2016.
Oh boy.
Yeah, we're going way back.
All right, who's buying?
Yeah, it sounds like a buying opportunity if you're a long Tesla long. But you know, things are a little bit scary right now. There's a lot of executive departures, like there always is. There's always some rumors of buyouts from not only, you know, local people like Google and Apple, but you know, theoretically a Chinese company could swoop in with $40 billion and
the Saudis maybe.
The Saudis obviously are a good, although they'd probably just shut it down.
Oh boy, yeah. One of the big investors in Tesla, is it Rowe? I think Tim Rowe.
Yeah,
they were holding like 8 million shares or something, and now it's down to 1 million over the last 2 quarters. So, who's buying that too? Like, well. It got diluted into the market for a while, so that's why probably the shares were down a lot too. But I'd be curious to see if more people are buying. But because we haven't heard more about the Saudis, almost 5% of that they bought from Tesla.
Yeah, it'd be interesting if they took any, you know, significant amount. If they jumped up to 15% or 20%, it would be
interesting. Did I have to disclose it at this point? So
right.
Probably not the case. Tesla Autopilot in Europe. That's a bummer here. Tesla is nerfing the Autopilot in Europe due to new regulations. So we talked a little bit about that before for the Model 3, where some owners were complaining that the Model 3 in Europe, the Autopilot wasn't like on par with what they were used to in Model S and X. That basically, the auto steer wasn't working as well. Wasn't taking turns that are a little bit sharper. But now we know why. It's confirmed that it's because of the new regulation in Europe, which is called the UNECE R79 regulation, and it's oversees the steering of the driver assistance system, and it limits the turning radius of a steering wheel that can be done automatically by the car. Which is kind of weird because, like, if you can prove that you can, like, steer it a little bit more and it's still safe, like, why are the regulators, like, limiting that to certain regions? Anyway, when Tesla launched the Model 3 a few months ago, they wanted to already comply to them because that thing came out last year. So since the Model 3 was released in Europe after the new UN regulation, they comply with it right away. But now Model S and X were approved under the previous regulation, so they still had the more complete auto-steer system. And now Tesla is reverting them to the old one, so it's retroactive, really. So if you guys are in Europe and you're updating to the 2019.16 software update, you're going to see that limitation on auto-steer. And you also have a limitation on initiating the auto-lane change. It needs to happen within 5 seconds of engaging it, so there's a bit different turn signal when activation of the turn signal for the auto lane change. So, not sure how big of an impact that is, but I think the auto steer thing is more important. And yeah, be aware of it. I mean, I don't know if I would recommend not updating because just this update alone, it comes with a few other updates. So, like, you gotta. You're gonna prevent yourself to get other features for trying to preserve that auto steer capability. So I don't know. It's up to you guys, but I'm pretty sure that some people are gonna decide not to update. What would you do?
I don't know.
You don't even use autopilot that much.
I'm not a big autopilot user, so I would probably just update.
Yeah, I like autopilot a lot, and. it would be frustrating if you, because it gets pretty good. I never feel the need to correct it in most driving. And now if I see a sharp turn, I'll start getting nervous. Okay, when do I need to take over? Do I need to take over now? So it's kind of stupid in my opinion. Even though you always need to pay attention and be ready to take control. So the point is, that's not the point, but if you anticipate always losing capability within the turn, it makes no sense to me. Or probably I would assume that Tesla would know ahead that the turn would be able to be handled by autosteer and will send you an alert to take over, but
yeah.
I've never experienced autopilot in Europe yet, so, and certainly not since the new regulations. All right.
I think we might have missed the one about the supercharger V3 being produced at the Gigafactory too.
Okay. Yeah, you're right. Yeah, there was a story that came out earlier this week from Reuters that Tesla's Gigafactory 2 in Buffalo was basically just being run by Panasonic now in terms of the solar side, because Tesla has a deal there like they have in Gigafactory 1 for battery cell, and Gigafactory 2 is for solar cells, where the original idea was for Panasonic to produce the solar cells and then sell them to Tesla on site to make the solar roof tiles, but the solar roof tiles haven't taken off yet. Tesla is still looking to ramp to exact. So most of the cells that Panasonic is producing right now at Gigafactory 2 are just going to other competitors to Tesla, other panel makers and other solar installers. So there's a big factory that it's producing solar products right now in Buffalo. It has Tesla's name on it, but it's mostly supplying Tesla competitors, which is weird.
Yeah, Tesla's solar installer competitors or solar panel maker competitors, because they're coming out of the factory as Panasonic panels. And anecdotally, I have a friend who's getting Panasonic panels, the 335s, on his roof, and they're Panasonic, and they're coming from the Gate factory. From a third-party installer. So that the Gigafactory 2 is producing solar panels. They're just not going to Tesla.
Yeah. Some of them are going to Tesla. Not the solar, some of the solar cells too, but for very little amount of solar roof tiles. On the module side, which was you was just referencing, a bunch of Panasonic-branded panels are going to other installers. But Tesla is also using some of those panels for their own rooftop retrofits. And I think they are using it, Tesla branded panels. They have a deal with Panasonic to brand them Tesla. And they're going to have a new one apparently coming later this year that's going to be sleeker, like all black. And I think it's going to be a 330 watts too, not 325. I think it's going to be a little bit more efficient or something. Something to look out for. But after that report came out, Tesla was like, hey, it's not just a Panasonic factory. We also produce other things there. And that's why they have they increased their headcount there. And they have to increase the headcount consistently due to the deal that they have with the state. Well, it's a deal that they inherited from SolarCity, which in turn inherited from... I forget the startup that...
Silevo? No.
Silevo, you're right. Silevo, yeah. That's a startup that SolarCity acquired, and then SolarCity was acquired by Tesla, and they had their original deal with the New York state for New York to pay for the factory, to pay like I think it was $750 million, and then rent it to now Tesla for like penny on the dollar, really. But in exchange, Tesla at that time Silevo, and at that time another time SolarCity, to hire a bunch of people in New York State. So since the solar rooftop thing hasn't taken off yet, Tesla has brought other energy products and even the supercharger V3 to be assembled there. While the parts are being made there, and then Tesla said they're also being assembled. There's one production line right now operating, and they have a few more coming later this year. So that's a good news, because we haven't seen a lot of superchargers V3. As far as we know, there's the one that's operational right now. It's been launched a few months ago, so we need to see more of them. And if there's a production line now working right now in Buffalo, hopefully it means that in the future, when Tesla opens new charging station, it's going to be the V3 versions of it.
Yeah, at least a few V3 chargers at each supercharger station.
You mean like it would be a mix of V2 and V3?
I think that's the idea, isn't it? Like long term to have both?
I mean, I know that they're going to keep the V2 technology of the, or the, at least the urban supercharger technology to do the... The one in cities and stuff. So you don't necessarily need a V3 there with the higher power output. But I think the goal for is like all new stations should be V3. It would make sense.
Yeah, I guess that makes sense. Yeah. It would just be nice if the current stations got at least one upgrade or one updated. And, you know, the one we saw in Los Angeles at the design studio, there was only one updated, and the other three, I think, were the old. So I don't know if they're going to update all of them. So
yeah,
we're not sure exactly what the plan is there.
Yeah, you can use a lot of the stuff that already is there, like the stalls themselves haven't changed much. The cables are new on the stalls, but the stalls themselves haven't changed much. The biggest difference is on the back end of it, like the cabinets, they call them, the supercharger cabinets. Those are brand new, so they need to deploy those, and I think that's what they're really producing in Buffalo now.
Okay. And then, yeah, that makes sense, because there's once you put the cabinets in, then you can put in a bunch of high-speed ones.
Mm-hmm. All right, Tesla started pursuing a new update of the BMS system following battery fires. So we've been reporting over the last few months, this seems to be like an increased number of Tesla battery fires.
Particularly in China.
Particularly in China, but also in the U.S. Just with Model S or X, no Model 3. As far as I know, there's been no Model 3 fire reported yet.
That's very interesting.
Yeah, that's interesting, especially since there are 100,000 of them out there now. But yeah, and what they're interesting is that it's not. We've seen plenty of Tesla fires, but most of them after an impact, after a crash, and that's nothing like very special about. Like a lot of cars, they burst out in flames after impact, especially if you have an inflammable tank of gas inside that car. But when it gets more worrying a little bit, if the car catches on fire on its own without seemingly any kind of impact or collision happened before, and those are the cases we're talking about. So we saw one in Pittsburgh last month, then a few days later, there was one in Shanghai, and then earlier this month, there was one in Hong Kong. And some of them, it's while charging, some of them, it's not charging, just parked, and they just burst into flame. And Tesla's response was always the same, like, oh, yeah, but on average, our cars are much less likely to catch on fire. It's like, yeah, we know that, we get that, and that should be publicized, sure, but still, you need to investigate and see why they catch on fire, because if they were catching a fire on their home, it's not normal in any way. And now they did that, and following the last case, they said that they started releasing a BMS software upgrade, which they say is only out of an abundance of caution. So it's not like they didn't say, like, oh, we are fixing the issue. It's just, I'm going to quote it here to be sure not to be precise. As we continue investigation of the root cause, out of an abundance of caution, we are revising charge and terminal management settings on Model S and X vehicle via an over-the-air software update that will begin rolling out today to help further protect the battery and improve battery longevity. So it cannot just be about preventing battery fires and that. It needs to be about something else too. And if it does result in battery longevity improvements, then I think we're all for it, right?
Yeah, absolutely.
But yeah, it's something to keep a look out for, because yeah, when they catch on fire on their own, it's weird.
So going back to what you said earlier, something I think we've all observed, there hasn't been any Model 3 battery fires of any sort. With impact, without impact, at a charging station, I don't think we've seen any, right?
Yeah, and that's interesting for a few reasons, because Tesla released a brand new battery cell in the Model 3, like the new 2170 mm-hmm. cells. They release a new battery pack architecture, new battery module architecture. So there's a bunch of things that change with the Model 3, presumably a new BMS too. So, I'm not sure if the data set is big enough to be statistically relevant yet.
Right, especially with the age of the
you're right.
Model S and X is out.
Yeah, so it's not just about the size of the data set, but it's also like how long it's been out there. That's right, because a lot of the cars that we're seeing catching in flames right now are older vehicles too. Well, I'm just saying that based on seeing that some of them have most of them have nose cones on the Model S. That's something that hasn't been on Tesla vehicles since 2016. So, not that whole of a cars. I mean, there's a car in my garage right now. It's 2012 my Tesla Model S. So, do I need to be worried? I should get a new update though. On the 2012 car. I mean, that car has been around for almost 8 years now, and
still getting updates.
That's fun. All right, let's move on from Tesla a little bit and talk about the reason I'm extremely tired now, because I haven't caught up on sleep since I've been to Norway next week, since I've been traveling nonstop over the last week. And that reason for going to Norway was to check out the Mercedes-Benz EQC. Daimler invited us there, and I think they invited us there for a reason that they think Oslo and Norway is going to be a big market for their EQC. It's a big market for it was my first time in Norway too. I really need to come back because it was a very short time and it was rainy and I didn't get to see much. But I still, even in my short time, I managed to be very impressed, especially just in the airport. We get out of the airport, we go to the parking garage in the airport. And here in the US, or most places, even though the places that are on board with electric vehicles, you see a charging station. And if you get like 20 chargers at the charging station, you're lucky. You get out of the Oslo airport and you go inside the garage, and it's not 20, it's hundreds of them, hundreds of charging stations everywhere. It's electric cars after electric cars. It was just walking around the parking lot was really an EV enthusiast's heaven, really. And yeah, we get to that parking lot, and then we get access to the car for the first time. I mean, I've been inside the EQC before, but that was my first time that I was able to drive it. And let's talk about the car a little bit first, the specs of the car, because it's coming out at a time that plenty of other premium SUVs are coming out. Like we talk a lot about the Audi e-tron, since it's right now hitting the market. Here in the US, it's been in Europe for a while. There is, of course, the Model X. It's been around for a while, but it's getting updated now. The drivetrain update came out last month. We expect an interior refresh later this year. We expect a new battery pack later this year. So it's still very a fresh vehicle. The I-Pace, if you want to call it an SUV, I don't, but some people do. Then there's the iX3 coming next year, and I say that because the EQC is only coming next year too for most markets. I mean, for the US at least.
And that's from BMW, right?
The iX3, yeah, BMW iX3, yeah. That's that's coming next year from China. They're gonna build them in China, then export them everywhere. So we don't know yet when it's gonna happen, but it sounds like it's next year. But I think that's a smaller vehicle though. iX3 is gonna be a little bit smaller. Though that EQC is not that big of a car either. Like a mid-size SUV built on the GLC platform. Well, I don't know if you can say it's built on the GLC platform. It's built on the same production line as the GLC. It shares about 15% of the parts with the GLC. But yeah, it's a brand new powertrain in it, of course, because the GLC is not electric. And updated design too. Though when you look at it, like it looks like a Mercedes-Benz SUV. It looks like a close cousin of the GLC.
Yeah, it doesn't look terribly exciting from the side. Obviously, the big Mercedes logo on the front. It has a grill that looks like it's a internal combustion car, to me at least.
But there's three different grills, right?
I think it's plastic, but it's like, why do they still have these huge grills? It doesn't make any sense.
Well, it doesn't when it comes to the Mercedes EQC, because there's some air intakes in there. There's some active control air intakes. So they're completely shut when you need to for aerodynamic purposes. But there's also some – they can open up to get some air intake to cool the motors and the battery packs. So there's some purpose to it. And they have three different fake grills there. They are, for the most part – you're right, they are fake for the most part. They are plastic. But there are some parts where there's an actual grill of it. And they do a pretty good job by making it seamless of where you don't see where it's an actual grill and where it's a fake grill, because of course it's not an engine in there, so you don't need a full air intake in the front. So for the most part, it's just about making it smooth. But yeah, I mean, aside from Tesla, there's no major automaker that was like ready to completely let go of the idea of having some kind of thing on the front to look like a grill. I mean, if you go to the Kona EV or the Niro, it's not like it does. There's still a shape of the grill, but it's clearly not a fake grill. I mean, it doesn't look like a fake, like a grill, but there's still the shape of a grill there. So everyone is very focused on that still. And that was Tesla back in 2012, 2016. It wasn't a grill. It wasn't like a fake grill, but it was a nose cone to like keep the form of a grill there. But it wasn't trying to look like a grill. This is still trying to look like a grill.
Right. I feel like Audi does that as well. Like, they have that iconic front, you know, with the grill, and they can't shake that no matter what.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think that plays into the entire idea of the car. I mean, really, because it's, in my opinion, it's a car made for people to transition to electric car as seamless as possible. You know, it's not too different from them, both on the visual aspect and on the actual driving experience of it. I called it in the headline of the review, I called it, it's an easy way for Mercedes drivers to go electric, meaning that for an hardcore electric vehicle fan like myself, it's not something that I would very much go towards, because I feel like it's a little bit dumbed down version of some features I'm used to as a Tesla driver and as like a non-car electric vehicle driver. But I can see why they made the decision. They made them because their idea is like we want to be able to convert easily gas-powered car drivers to... Easily is the key word here, because you could still convert people with... like Tesla has been doing it for years now with a more impressive step, like a bigger step you need to take to go electric, but they want it to be a smart step. And giving you some example of that, the regenerative braking settings, you have how many of them? You have 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 different regenerative settings. In a Tesla vehicle, it's 2. You have high, you have low. That's, well, I think not even high, it's standard and low, whatever. And the standard is pretty high. It's pretty strong regenerative braking. And this one, you could compare the standard of a Tesla to the high recuperation system, which is they call the D-. You control them like many of the cars now, where you have paddles on each side of the steering wheel. But yeah, if you do that, they call it one pedal driving, but that's not even true. And that's one of the reasons why they are focusing on the transition, easy transition from a gas-powered car to an electric car. The one-pedal driving is not real one-pedal driving, because they always have creep on. You cannot remove creep on the car. It always has creep. So even if you, to come to a complete stop, you have to press the brake pedal. And if you want to hold it, the only way to remove any creep is to do a full press on the gas pedal, the accelerator. So not the accelerator, sorry, the brake pedal. So yeah, it's not a completely real pedal driving, because they wanted to maintain creep. And when I asked them, can you even like just hide deep in the setting an option to remove creep? And they were like, no, we don't want to do that. That's going too far away from a gas-powered car. All right.
So overwhelmingly, it feels like they are trying to ease people into the transition from going from internal combustion to an electric car. So what it sounds like is like they've made absolutely the least amount of changes possible to go from gas to electric.
Yeah, I wouldn't say the least amount of changes, because they still did a lot of work there in terms of some features where they are pushing for make it easy to... I mean, it's hard, because I don't want to bash them for their effort, because I know what they're trying to do, but I think ultimately it's not pushing the technology forward. It's just, the way I see it is that if they're not looking to get like new market share there in the EV world. They're just looking not to lose too many market shares to other people. So like Tesla has been stealing a lot of shares from Mercedes Benz. Now at least Mercedes can have an option, tell the buyers, all right, don't buy a Tesla. We have an electric option if you want to go electric, and it's going to be an easy option for you to go electric. You don't have to learn the Tesla system, which I think is very easy and intuitive, but if you're used to the user interface of Mercedes Benz, then that's going to be a much easier transition for you. So I don't know. A few other stuff for the driving experience. They have a 5 different driving modes: Comfort, Eco Mode, Max Range Mode, and Sport Mode. We didn't drive that much, so I mostly used the Sport Mode to be able to like get the highest performance out of the car, which was quite fun, really. I was very interested in the individual mode, where you can actually customize your own driving mode with a bunch of different settings. So I couldn't get into that. I didn't have enough time to get into that, but that would have been really interesting. I look forward to if I can spend a little bit more time with the car to try to build myself like a very efficient or a very fun driving settings. The most important one in terms of the electric version of it, like, is a max range one, which was very weird to experience. The only thing that it does really is that it knows the speed limit of where you're driving, and it's going to limit the top speed to that speed limit, but not by limiting the top speed by software, but by putting a pressure point in the accelerator pedal. So as you press the accelerator, when you reach the top speed, the speed limit, because of course, the higher you go over the speed limit, the lower is going to be your efficiency, the lower is going to be your range, and the idea of the mode is to increase the range. There's a pressure point there, and it's a pretty hard pressure point too. So if you can override it, but you really have to press hard on it to override it. I couldn't handle it for more than 10 minutes on the highway or something like that, because it's just annoying. Like sometimes you need to pass someone or whatever. You want to have that capability, and not having to overcome it, like a very strong pressure point in the pedal, is just not fun. So I think it can still be useful, but really as a last resort when you actually think you're gonna need some more range. Speaking of the range on the car, they just released the WLTP for it, and it's getting 259 miles of range, 417 kilometers.
So what's that translate to EPA? Probably about 220?
Ooh, I'd be surprised if it gets 220. I think it's going to be closer to 210 or something like that. But maybe even 2. I don't know.
So similar to the e-tron?
Very similar to. Actually, it's the same WLTP as the e-tron. So okay. So the EPA should be similar.
Precedent.
But yeah. It was interesting, though. So Audi, the way that they talk, they are way more open to Audi when it comes to the battery capacity that they have. They say it's a 95 kilowatt battery pack because that's the full total potential energy capacity of the pack. But they are open about the fact that there's only 83.6 kilowatt hour of usable energy capacity in the car, because they leave reserves 4% at the top and 8% at the bottom of the battery pack. So they never go below 8% and they never go over 96%. Of the energy capacity of the pack. Mercedes is going the completely other way around. They tell you that you have 80 kilowatt hour of usable capacity, so about 3.6 less than Audi. But that's not the full energy capacity of the pack, and they don't even tell you what's the full energy capacity of the pack. They didn't want to release that information at all. So it's quite strange, because they are getting exactly the same. Well, that's not that strange, because they're getting the same range on the similar battery pack, just 3.6 kilowatt hour fewer of our energy capacity. But the car is a little bit smaller too. It's quite aerodynamic, and it's a little bit smaller than the e-tron. So it does that makes sense on that part. But then you kind of want to know like what you're buying too. Like, what's the total energy capacity of the pack? It's unclear. And if you look at the Audi e-tron, that 4% reserve on top does give you a big advantage of, it doesn't have that big of an impact if you charge 100%, because you know that charging to 100% is charging to 96%, really. also for their charging speed, it's been extremely useful for the charging speed, because we know that the Hot Z e-tron gets to that 155 kilowatts of charging output very, very quick. And it maintains a high charging output throughout the entire cycle of it. And that's because at the if you look at the very end of it, it's still, like, for the last 10%, it's still, like, at 80 to 70 kilowatts. So that's pretty strong. And they do that because they're not really at close to 100%, 90 to 100%. They're closer to 86 to 96%. You don't see that in the Mercedes as much. It's charged to up to 110 kilowatts. I couldn't get it to 110, but when I stop at the, first of all, you need a 150 kilowatt charger. We did have one. There was a high-end ET charger near the airport, but I arrived there at around 40% or a little less than 40%, and I got up to 87 kilowatts when I was at around 50% charge. I didn't charge it to a full charge either, but the last 50% looked like it was going to take about 40 minutes. So it's definitely not close to a 70 kilowatt charge rate when I'm past like 70% or something like that. So
yeah. So that kind of brings us to the next next point or the next post. I don't want to rush you though. Yeah. Audi kind of touts its ability to charge over a long period of time at 150 up to 80%, whereas even Tesla's quick charge, 250 kilowatt charge, almost at 10%, it starts to taper off.
Yeah. That was earlier this week when I was with Audi and at Northern California to test the e-tron on a road trip. And they did an interesting presentation where they started overlaying all the different charging cycles of a bunch of electric cars. And they released an interesting chart that we posted on Electrek, where they started by showing the BMW i3, because they said like it was one of the first like liquid-cooled battery pack that could charge up to 50 kilowatts. And they wanted like to give them props for that. But that, of course, the i3 is a whole car at this point. And yeah, it could maintain a fairly high charge rate through most of the cycle. Then they showed the I-Pace, which of course is very at the bottom of the new generation of 100 kilowatt capable vehicle. They showed the Tesla on a 90D battery pack. So that was to show like the V2 generation of supercharger, at least before the last update that goes up to 155 kilowatt. And it also shows that it tempers pretty quick, though closer to maybe 50% state of charge. And then they showed, of course, the e-tron, which is the winner on that capability of maintaining a high charge rate throughout the end of the charging struggle.
It's the winner if you're charging to, you know, 80 to 100%, maybe to 100%. But like a lot of people, they just charge until they get, you know, enough range to get to the next spot to go. I think a lot of times the Model 3 will beat that.
Yeah, I wasn't talking about the V3 yet. I was just talking about like those one, the winner on that.
Yeah,
when they were saying that, because I was thinking like, oh, are they gonna compare it to the V3 then? And sure enough, they compared to the V3, but we don't have a lot of data on the V3. So all they could use, they didn't testing themselves, so they couldn't overlay like a perfect thing. But they did use one chart that Tesla released. Because if you look at the charts, they don't actually start at all the same state of charge. So they have to cut that one. Like Audi does it from 10% to 100%. The Tesla one was from like 8% to... 90% or something. So it's not a perfect comparison either. But yeah, you're right. It depends on your use case. I mean, if you are very low on charge, here else to look at it. If you want to do a 400-mile road trip, you have a Model 3 that does 300 miles, you need only 100 more miles to do it. You get to 300 miles and there's a supercharger station. You arrive at a very low state of charge, like less than 10%. then yeah, that V3 is going to be perfect for you, because you're going to get that 100 miles of range faster than anything else on the market. So you're going to complete that 400 miles road trip a lot faster. But then how these use cases are going to be different is they get lower range, but they can maintain the charge rate for a longer period of time. So for a full charge, you're still going to be able to get a decent amount of range in a short period of time. But and their idea is that you're going to always stop at around 80%, because that's when their charge rate tempers off, while Tesla charge rate tempers off around 10%. But through that temper from 10% to 50%, it's still higher than the Hadi. So there's that too.
Yeah, and in addition to that, the Model 3 gets way more miles per kilowatt hour. So even if the Audi's charging faster, the Tesla might be getting more miles per hour of charge. This isn't to like slight Audi at all. It's actually very impressive how their vehicle charges, and frankly, like, that's kind of setting the new standard for the rest of the industry.
Mm.
But there's still a lot of advantage. Like, you know, a Model 3 owner doesn't have to be envious, because they're charging faster in almost every situation.
Yeah. Of course, that's for the Model 3. You comparing a Model 3 to Audi e-tron, which of course makes doesn't make much sense. They're not in the same segment. The better comparison would have been the Model X on V3, but we haven't seen that yet. There's been the update last week that says it can charge up to 200 kilowatts, so we would still need to see like a full driving cycle on the Model X on V3. And of course, everything we just said is a moot point if there's no more V2 supercharger station and 150 kilowatt station for Audi, because there's not that many of those either, especially in the US. They're getting more of them, but it's still somewhat limited. So we need to see more of those, and we need to see more V2 supercharger. Then we can start to look more specifically on how vehicle charge on these different charging solution. And to be fair to Audi, I want to mention, because we keep like beetling, is that word? Making it so that it's not as important, their charge rate, like it's not as impressive, because they have that reserve on top of the battery capacity. But they say that's just a part of the reason why it's fast, and you can see that on the charge rate, like up to 70%, like that they stay up to 150 and more kilowatts. That's not because of the reserve on top. The reserve explained maybe the last 10% or something, but not up to 70%.
Yeah, it's impressive, for sure.
That is explained through what they say is their cooling system. They have a very powerful cooling system, and they're able to control the thermal state of the batteries throughout the entire charging process. That's why I was talking to them. You guys saw the Tesla's new software update that... if you enter the navigation system, you enter the supercharger location, it knows when it's going to arrive at the station, and it's going to precondition the battery pack as you arrive there to be able to achieve that high start. Because that's why Tesla is able to hit 250 so fast. Most of the charging station, it takes a while for the charge rate to get high too. I mean, the longer you're there, the higher your chance that it's going to temper. But also, the longer you're there, the longer the battery gets to prepare themselves and be able to accept a higher charge rate. So there's two things. You want to be able to maintain that charge rate for a longer period of time, and you want to be able to achieve that charge rate quick by making sure that your batteries are okay, are ready to accept it. Tesla is beating everyone on that front. On the second part of it, with the V3, it gets there super fast. Audi said, We don't need that feature. Like we could implement that feature. It's pretty easy to implement. It's pretty simple. It's just, you know where the battery is. You enter in the navigation system and you prepare by the time you get there. When Tesla released that, we're like, why didn't we think of that before? But so everybody should do that. They said, we look into it and we don't need to do it. That's how good our cooling system is. You plug it in and it does take it gets to start at 140 or something and then goes up to 150 pretty quick. But even to get that F-155, like it still takes a while. So interesting stuff, though.
And then one last story. Hyundai and Kia are going to team up with Rimac, which kind of a surprising team up there, but to build an electric sports car.
Yeah, that's the second part I was more interested in. The fact that it means we're going to see a sports car from Hyundai or Kia or both. I don't know. But yeah, I mean, if it can be, what I had in mind, okay, it could be like a supercar. What do you think? Do you think it's going to be a supercar, or is it going to be like a somewhat affordable sports car?
I don't know. I don't think Rimac makes affordable.
They don't, but they also just make supercars. Yeah, but they wouldn't make the car there. They're just using supply the battery technology behind it. Right? I think it's Kia and Nio that's gonna and the Hyundai is gonna make the car, and Rimac is gonna make the battery technology. So it could still be like a. I was thinking maybe like a reasonable like 60,000 to 80,000 because it's still gonna be a Hyundai and a Kia car. It's gonna be a Hyundai branded hand brand vehicle.
It'll be like a Nissan Nismo kind of.
Yeah, but you cannot sell those cars for no one's buying a Hyundai for $200,000. Like, you know what I mean? So it's still gonna be like a fairly available car. I think if anyway, it's still weird that they went from having Porsche as a partner to now having Hyundai and Kia. It's like two different part of the spectrum of automakers, I think.
Well, Rimac got a few partners. I mean, we know they work with Jaguar. That we know they work with Koenigsegg.
I meant as an investment partner. So they are part owner now.
Right,
Porsche. They're not just working with Porsche. Porsche is owns like a significant percentage of the company now.
But I think Jaguar for sure is working with them.
Yeah,
I think maybe some of the parts of the I-Pace were farmed out to Rimac, and maybe not implicitly, but you know, maybe there was some consulting there.
Weren't they working with them on the new? The Converger kit that they want to do for the older Jaguar? I think that was
part of that. Yes. They were doing, Rimac was doing the conversion kits for the, and you know, the
F-Type? The print.
Right. One of those.
Yeah, that should be cool. I want to see that car coming. But yeah, Rimac are always doing some fun things. I mean, we visited them earlier this year. We sent Micah to take a look, and he was really impressed by the operation.
Yeah, he was there to see the Grape electric bike. Yeah. But also something less worthy if you're into electric bikes.
Mm-hmm.
So they make a lot of good stuff there. It's kind of jealous that we don't get to visit them more often.
Yeah, I mean, they until very recently they were mostly like just a supercar maker, which of course is not as appealing because I mean a handful of people can get those cars, and they're only making a handful anyway. But it's very interesting because. People forget that Rimac, like, they've been around for a long time. They've been at it, like, I think 2007 or something they've been founded. And even before that, that guy, is it Matt, I think is his name? Matt Rimac?
Matt, yeah.
Yeah. He had the BMW, souped-up BMW electric conversion that he made before. Because they've been around for, like, 10 years, and the CEO, Matt, is still, like, in his 30s or something. And just now, they're starting to transition, I think, from like a supercar maker into more of a electrification supplier for other automakers. And I think it could be interesting for the future.
And just a podcast exclusive, I've heard Apple has talked to him a few times about their car. So maybe there's something interesting happening there as well.
Yeah. That'd be weird, though, because I thought it would be more a little bit mass market for everybody. But.
Well, who knows? But you know, I don't know where the talks went, but I know there was talk of a meeting where a bunch of Apple executives flew out to Croatia to talk to
Mate. Well, they could be interested in the battery technology for sure. But
yeah,
because Apple has never made a battery pack for cars. And it sounds like now they're making one for sure.
Yeah.
I heard a bunch of people recently for vehicle dynamics too, so it's I think everyone's agree now that Apple is not just working on a self-driving system; they're working on a full car. So that's interesting. All right, that's about it for us this week. Thanks a lot for listening, guys. Thanks a lot for watching on YouTube. We're gonna see you same place, same time next week. Have a good one.